You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org. Hello, and welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. Do not be shocked by the sound of my voice. I'm just filling in for editors Rob and Susie this week because they're on vacation. Hi, I'm Deep Tran. I'm your associate editor, and I'm sitting here with...
Russ Dembin, production editor.
And Allison Considine, the editorial assistant.
So today we're going to be talking about our April issue, which just came into the offices today, fresh from the printers. Or was it yesterday?
We got our advance copies yesterday, and we got our first official shipment today. So look for it in your mailboxes and on your local newsstands.
And online, because today as we're recording this, our entire package of stories about theater for young audiences, which was the focus of the print issue, is online and currently making many splashes in different directions, so which is very exciting. And then we'll also be talking about this exciting new grant program in New York City for theater non-for-profits. And speaking on the theme of theater for young audiences, we'll get a little bit personal and talk about our own first experiences at the theater. So that should be a fun discussion. And then we'll head into the main portion of this podcast, which is an interview that Rob conducted before he left with David Saar, the founding artistic director of Child's Play in Tempe, Arizona, and Linda Hartzell, the artistic director of Seattle Children's Theater. They're pioneers within the TYA field, and they're both retiring. Rob talked to them about their long careers and career highlights and what they'll be doing next. So stay tuned for that. First off, the April issue. Russ, do you want to take us through it? Because you like children more than I do.
Sure, Deep, and that's news to me that you are less fond for the young people than I am. I happen to love young people, especially because they are the future. So let's take a look at this April issue. It's actually a really solid installment of the magazine, and I'm sure that you will enjoy reading it as much as we enjoyed putting it together. The inspiration for this issue, we took a detail from our most recent edition of Theater Facts, which is published by Theater Communications Group, and there was a finding from 118 theaters that participated in the survey over the five-year period between 2010 and 2014. The analysis in Theater Facts revealed that although overall attendance had taken a slight dip, there was an increase in attendance for programming for young people. And so we decided to take a closer look at Theater for Young Audiences programming across the country to specify that detail was focusing on TYA programming at non-TYA specific theaters. So that was an interesting piece of information for us and led us to take a closer look at this part of our field. And we have a bunch of great stories that, as Dee pointed out, are online today, the day of recording. And so we have a look from Emma Halpern at TYA licensing. So we're looking at kind of a canon of Theater for Young Audiences pieces of sorts, but specifically at what licensing companies do and how they function with specifically TYA material. We also have our installment of Production Notebook looking at the Rose Theater in Omaha, Nebraska, and its staging of A Child's Garden of Verses, which focuses on preschool audiences. Exciting stuff there. And of course, we also have a great back of the book with a couple of profiles and a cool story about another Theater for the Very Young piece, which Deep wrote about Ann Carlson and Animal Dance, which is at Children's Theater Company in Minneapolis.
Ironically, because I just came in for the animals, not so much the toddlers. Joking aside, and we also have, in this issue, besides the TYA components, we also have a really fantastic interview that Rob did with Todd Hames, the artistic director of Roundabout Theater Company. And it's a very frank and candid look at how you build an institution that has not just multiple off-Broadway spaces, but a Broadway space. And then how do you balance that with the pressures from commercial theater producers? So very frank, honest discussion about money issues.
And you may have noticed that when we have stories in the print edition of our magazine, we often have a slightly longer version on the web. And this is a great example of that happening, because if you take a look at the Todd Hames Q&A, it's got some really excellent material in the print article, but online, some really great tidbits that we had to leave out for space reasons.
And speaking of online, we also have a selection of online-only TYA-related stories. And so, Allison, do you want to talk a little bit about the piece that you edited?
So, our intern, Maggie Gilroy, and I, we compiled a list of theaters that have theater for young audiences within their program year-round, and also some that just have children's shows built within their season subscription. So it's a look at 20 different theaters. Gosh, they're from Honolulu all the way to the East Coast and Boston, and just the types of programming that they put up, and some of their the artistic director spoke about some of their favorite past productions. So take a look at that and find a theater in your area and bring a kid.
Or go yourself. That's fine too. Because it's great theater regardless of your age.
And our next order of business is, so we wanted to do a quick shout out to this really cool new grant opportunity for anyone who's in New York City. Recently, the New York Department of Cultural Affairs released a study saying that the staff members at New York City arts non-for-profits, which includes theater, music, art galleries, the staff is disproportionately white in relation to New York City's population. The staff breakdown at these organizations were 61.5% white in relation to the New York City population, which is 33% non-Hispanic white. In relation to this, the Theater Subdistrict Council in New York City has announced a granting program giving out up to $2 million total in grants to various theaters or theater-related organizations to train artists so that they could diversify their staff, which is a really exciting initiative. And it seems to be one of many initiatives that have currently been cropping up to put in money in order to diversify the field, such as the Directors Fellowships at OSF, Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
The Spark Leadership Program here at Theater Communications Group has also been contributing largely to those efforts. And these initiatives are so valuable because really the best way to make our theater community more inclusive and more diverse and best represent our wonderfully varied and fascinating nation is to include more diverse voices in more various parts of the theater making process as possible. And this is really the greatest way to get the widest variety of perspectives and voices involved, just to have this diversity all across the spectrum.
Right. It's kind of putting our money where our mouths are, so to speak. A big topic for me is the issue of accessibility. And as we all know, the theater field is quite inhospitable if you don't have the funding either from family or from fellowships to pursue your art while you work a day job or work for free or do whatever it is you need to do in order to, you know, make work. And so initiatives like these kind of level the playing field, especially for people coming from underrepresented and underserved organizations. And so we commend you guys, Theater Sub-District Council in New York City, and we're looking forward to seeing more initiatives like this.
Much to be excited about. Absolutely.
So, on a more fun note, we were discussing before we recorded this podcast our very first theatrical experiences, because we were all kids once. So,
Deep, I'm eager to hear yours, so please go first.
I wasn't a kid. I was 14 before I saw my first theater
show. No kidding.
Show.
You said Deep Tran, associate editor of American Theater Magazine, first saw theater at 14 years old.
And what did you see, Deep?
What did you see, Deep?
I saw a touring production of The Lion King in Los Angeles, only because my sister told me, oh my God, the puppets in it are fantastic. We should go. It'll be a nice, fun experience. And we love the movie, and so that was the entry point for us.
Wait, did you see any theater before Broadway Across America?
No.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Why is that so surprising to people?
I don't know, because usually we talk about TYA, about children's theater, these various movements, and I think a lot of people who make theater a profession encounter it earlier on and maybe not a lavish commercial production like that. So that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, well, it's also an issue of access, because in Anaheim, where I grew up, the biggest theater nearby was South Coast Repertory. Mm. But then for my parents, who were immigrants and who worked really long hours, there wasn't really the knowledge there or the outreach to those communities to come to the theater and to be, you know, exposed to those different kinds of things. And also, it's a money thing, because when you're
right,
because where we were, a family of four, and so very, very few lower income families can afford a night at the theater. Well, so insofar as to say, make tickets cheaper, everyone. That would be so helpful. Even though I don't really know what the going rates are for institutions like Child's Play or Imagination Stage, but
yeah, now that I think about it, I believe the first time that I saw what many people would call a professional production was also Broadway. I was 12, or I was 11, but whatever. It was commercial theater. It was the first time. I don't think I saw a not-for-profit production until I was older. Cause where I grew up on Long Island in New York, there's this robust community theater scene that is different from what might be considered community theater in other parts of the country. Mm-hmm. We're not talking Waiting for Guffman. Although I'm sure that there's great community theater out there that isn't Waiting for Guffman, but on Long Island, there's this really strong community theater scene where theaters that I don't know if you'd call them professional. They're certainly not TCG member theaters. They're not big, high budget companies necessarily, but they do lots of great work and a lot of revivals of well-known pieces, a lot of stuff like Neil Simon. And so my first encounter with the theater was at one of those companies, one of those theaters, a children-oriented show. Mine was The Emperor's New Clothes. And I think it was five, I guess. And all I remember, this is the only detail I recall from this show, was the very end where the Emperor came out in nothing but white boxers with red hearts on them. And the kids all cackled at that. And that's the detail that I remember. That was my first theater experience.
Well, I guess I win, because I was a mere 3 years old.
Ah, well done.
Oh. I went as part of my preschool, went on a field trip to see a children's production of Winnie the Pooh. And I remember, I have this image in my mind of Piglet coming down the aisle, and that's what sticks out for me. But something about that production really did stick with me, because I found out that I wasn't able to participate in community theater until I was 7 years old. And it really stuck with me, because on my seventh birthday, as my mom likes to tell everyone, I woke up excited, because that was the day I could sign up to be part of my first play, which was The Wizard of Oz. And I went on to be a flying monkey and a poppy seed and a raindrop. And I've been doing theater ever since.
A poppy seed and a raindrop.
Yeah, there's lots
that
of costume
is
changes.
So cool.
Wait, did they rig you and make you fly and everything?
They didn't. But we had a really great choreography that made us look like we were flying. No, but I will say then my first professional theater production that I saw was Beauty and the Beast, and I was 7. So I guess that's a trend with us.
It's always Disney.
It is always Disney.
Or Phantom of the Opera, because I remember my girlfriends and I in high school, we were obsessed with Phantom of the Opera. Well, that was around the time the movie came out, and so we were very into the dark, tortured rebel musician kind of type. Though now that I'm older, I realize he was a horrible, creepy stalker of a person. But you know, when you're 16, it just seems so romantic.
In my high school drama program, the fixation was on Rent and Wicked.
Mm-hmm. Wait, didn't you tell us that you played something in high school that was... Well, did you do theater in high school, Russ?
Yes, I did.
Oh, it was because when you and I saw Pericles, you were talking about how you played Pericles when you were in school.
I did.
And I thought that was really advanced because I didn't read Pericles until I was somewhere in college.
As it turns out, my high school is currently celebrating its 30th year of producing high school Shakespeare. Sanford H. Calhoun High School in Merrick, New York, celebrating its 30th anniversary with Sal Salerno at the helm of doing Shakespeare. And they do such strong work with their Shakespeare production. Sometimes they'll do 2 in a season. And they always bring their Shakespeare to the Hofstra University Shakespeare Festival, where they have local high schools come and bring a scene. Sometimes, it's a medley of scenes. I believe that they just changed their format slightly. But I think that still happens, bring a scene or a combination of scenes. But I bring this up because, a lot of people I think would rightly assume that high school Shakespeare might not be the best. But at my school, we took it very seriously, and our teacher gave us pretty rigorous training in voice and speech to prepare us and how to do a close reading. So, yes, Pericles, I can't speak to how well it turned out, but in general, their Shakespeare productions are very strong.
I feel like I'm the only person on the American theater staff that has never acted in a high school production of anything.
That was going to be my next question to you.
Yeah. No, no.
We'll have to get you up on a stage.
Didn't you? Wait. Yes. For one of the immersive shows, they brought you in, right?
Yeah. But I didn't have any lines, I don't think. I just ad-libbed most of it at the time.
That's close enough for my book.
Yes, I did the Speakeasy Dollhouse thing
right.
On the Lower East Side, which is like a murder mystery type of experience. And then I wrote about it in 2013. So far has been the only professional thing I've done. I don't even know if that production had equity actors. But Allison, did you do high school drama club kind of theater, or were you just professional also during those years too?
Both.
Oh, wow. No, that's why she's the actor in the room.
I went to Wyoming Seminary in Kingston, Pennsylvania. It's neither a seminary nor in Wyoming, but it has a pretty amazing performing arts school. So I had just switched over for high school just to take advantage of all these opportunities that they have with their drama club and music. I'm trying to think of some of my favorite roles, but we did Titanic the musical, which I think is seldom done at high schools, or anywhere rather. but that was a highlight. We did Little Shop of Horrors. We did Arcadia. I think that was something that was big for a high school to tackle. I played Hannah Jarvis. Mm. So yeah, high school theater is a fun time.
You guys did really advanced stuff at your high schools, because I just remember a lot of Neil Simon and Thornton Wilder at my high school drama clubs, which is why I never went. Awesome. So before we go too far down this memory lane, I'm going to segue us into the next segment of the podcast, which is an interview Rob did with David Saar of Child's Play and Linda Hartzell of Seattle Children's Theater, and hear them talk about their careers and the highlights of that. So enjoy that interview and come back to us later for our recommendations.
I'm here with two giants of the TYA field, you might say. Veterans, I don't want to make you feel old. But you both have been at it for 3 or 4 decades, basically. And you both have either retired or are leaving at the end of this season. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Yes.
This is my 39th season. Mm-hmm. 40 seemed excessive,
yeah. Yes. And this is David Saar from Child's Play, Arizona, yes. In Tempe. And then, Linda, this is your last season as well at Seattle Children's
right.
Theater, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
you started
right.
in 1984, I think I have.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And it had been only been around about 9 years itself, right, when you started
and,
there?
Yeah, it was founded in 1975 as a program in the Parks Department. For 3 years, I was in the first acting company from 76 to 79, so I was... It was then called Poncho Theater, so I actually started in 76, but as the artistic director, came in 1984, and unlike David, I am not the founding artistic director of Seattle.
No, but you were working at it the year before I was. That's amazing. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
You founded the theater in 77 with a bunch of folks, right?
77 is when we're actually incorporated, yeah. The first production was probably was in 76 sometime, I think.
Oh, okay. All right.
It grew out of a need to prove to the Department of Theater at Arizona State that I could direct.
Okay.
All of my training had been, and my experience had been, ensemble-based theater. And so I gathered a group of people, and we discovered that performing for this audience was so satisfying and enjoyable that we just kept on. Hmm. But it was very much an avocation for the first year or so. Everybody had day jobs, you know.
I wonder, this might be jumping ahead a little bit, but I wanted to just ask, since you've both been at it for a while, what are some of the biggest changes that you've seen in the TYA field? I mean, it might take us back to what was it like then, and how did it become what it is now? It's now, you're both running multi-million dollar theaters with your own spaces. So I don't know who wants to jump in there. Like, it sounded like it was pretty grassroots to start with. And it's become very professionalized since then. Would that be fair to say?
Very fair. Yeah, we were very much a weekend and summer vacation gig. As I said, everybody had day jobs, and
yeah.
So it worked around. And our big change really came when we were selected to be a part of the Kennedy Center's new Imagination Celebration that was hosted here in Phoenix.
Okay.
And got about 6 weeks of work, and by God, that didn't account for a full-time job. And so that was sort of when the split came, hired other performers, added to the company, and it went on from there. That really gave us our inroads into the schools, which is where we were for years exclusively, mm-hmm. Before we began a public season.
I think changes, certainly for David's Theater and Seattle Children's Theater, there were other theaters, but I'll mention three that were in existence longer than ours. Nashville Children's Theater,
okay.
Honolulu Theater for Youth, and Children's Theater Minneapolis. Certainly, I think what we've seen over the 30-some years that we've been working on is many more organizations growing up in particularly regional cities, you know, outside of New York, although there's good work happening there, and in L.A., some more theaters being founded, more institutions building facilities. I think you're seeing, not that there was not really strong professional work being done before, but I think what you've seen over the last 30, 40 years is the standards by which we're all commissioning scripts, we're designing and building scenery. We are paying our artists have grown. So when say we're doing professional work, that means people are being paid, and as well as providing educational opportunities for young people to take classes and perform. But we are working with top notch artists in every
and the classes step. Are taught by professional artists.
Mm-hmm.
So
like we're 100% we're 100% union. We're Equity, IATSE,
right.
STC designers. That doesn't mean some cities have gone union, others do not, but we all, most of us, David and I, we're best friends. Our organizations believe in professional work for our audiences.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it's a fairly close-knit, you're all aware of each other's work in this field, right? And of each other personally.
Very
yes.
much so.
Yeah, yes.
There's a very strong sort of national connection, I think.
Yes.
SCT is my second theater home, I think. And Linda's directed down here, great contacts with Metro Theater Company, with Coterie in Kansas City, with mm-hmm. Peter in Minneapolis. Scott just passed, but Nashville, and just, it is, a in I think it grew out of necessity.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
When we all began in this attempt to professionalize our profession, there wasn't much outside support from the rest of the theater community, it often felt.
Mm-hmm.
That has drastically changed. But I mean, I think initially we banded together for support of each other
right.
in all of our different situations, all of our different communities. Familiar problems emerged. You know, people tore their hair out. Linda's my go-to. I gotta cry now. space, and I think that's vice versa, and so that initial support, but the regard for the field has changed.
Yeah,
and there's a much more a much stronger and more honest embracing of what we do by the theater community as a whole.
Absolutely. Starts in our own hometowns, but nationally. David's right. I think we were responding to ideas and phrases like it's only for children, it's just for children mm-hmm. in the beginning. Where we connect now and talk about it is we love the audience. We really feel that we are introducing people to the theater,
mm-hmm.
Not just children, but adults who have never been interested in theater, cared about theater. They're coming because of their kids. So
right.
we want to give them the best work possible if they are going to continue to be theater goers. But we also, theater for young audiences tends to be, because of the nature of a lot of the stories we're doing, whether it's the Royal Shakespeare Company's Animal Farm or James and the Giant Peach.
Uh-huh.
Our stories tend to be highly theatrical.
Right.
And so for 30 years, we've been doing non-literal, minimalist kinds of staging of shows, which has been particularly popular in New York in the last 7 or 8 years. But theater for young audiences, because we're so connected to theater organizations around the world, have been doing highly challenging, highly theatrical staging to tell the kinds of stories that we tend to tell. So we talk a lot.
Now, David, you mentioned that Linda was someone you went to cry to or to commiserate with, right?
Commiserate.
Could you tell me what were some of the challenges along the way, apart from the general overhanging misconceptions about children's theater? What were some of the real material challenges? Were they the kind of challenges that any growing theater faces trying to capitalize and professionalize, or was
yes,
it other kinds of things?
There are other things. I mean, there are other, our audience's needs are different. The gatekeepers are in control. Initially, it was ours. The teachers, that's the parents.
Okay.
And they are often, actually parents are, I think, are often more protective
yeah.
of their young people. We are able, we have still a large touring program out in the schools throughout the state and throughout the country now. We are able to do much more daring work in the schools because we've been doing it for 35 years and the teachers trust us.
Mm.
They're willing to take something that does not necessarily have a book title. because they know we have a commitment to the child to their education, to giving both them and their young people a theater experience that both will enjoy and be able to talk about and learn from.
Right.
But that's in a bigger thing. We're not, you know, we're not pounding books, but
yeah.
There's a bigger. Education is a part of our mission. It's part of our DNA.
I'll say what I've called David about the last 10 years very quickly is because all of us, and I'm sure the same with you at TCG and the magazine, you've all talked about this as conferences. When we started out, we have experienced one of the biggest cultural changes in my lifetime as trying to produce and present programming for audiences since the discovery and the daily use of us being on a computer using the internet,
technology.
Going to an iPhone, going to an iPad, having texting, having social media. And so all of us, whether we run theaters, a ballet, an opera, a symphony, have just struggled since the late 90s because people are communicating and finding entertainment in a whole different way. And all of us we had hundreds of thousands of people attending our theater. We had 280,000 people attending our theater in the late 90s. And then, as I said, all those things started to happen in the next decade. 1,000 of people a year were not coming. Hmm. So I think all of us across the country and in other in Europe, other countries have tried a variety of things to try to get audiences back, and it's been frightening and frustrating for all of us. That's where we needed support from each other. As to how parents raise their children and what's a concern to them and to teachers as they make choices about buying a ticket, it's gone all the way from in the 80s to not wanting to see anything with witches in it, so no Roald Dahl, because that was satanic, the next thing of us seeing children with shorter attention spans and listening skills that weren't the same. I think the scariest thing for us now that we're dealing with is parents don't want their children to see, since September 11th, they don't want to see anything that's sad. So Charlotte's Web is maybe not a choice because the kids are going to be sad. I think the last thing is we're seeing kind of sociopathic behavior. Sometimes kids not having empathy and feeling a connection to community. So we've been all talking to each other, trying to understand audiences and therefore the programming choices that we're making.
Wow. That's some heavy stuff. It makes me think about, when I was looking into this, one of the plays that put you on the map, David, was The Yellow Boat about your son. And I know that it was done at Seattle did it in the 90s, I think, right?
Yes.
And we're also publishing along with this, I don't know if you heard Finnegan Kruckemeyer's speech about the taboo of sadness.
Yes, of course. We commissioned him, and we're on our second piece with him.
Unfortunately, not everyone in the world has seen The Yellow Boat, David. I don't know if you want to talk about that at all. It's a play you wrote in 1987 about your son's death.
Actually, 93.
93, okay. I thought it was earlier than that. Okay.
87 is when he died.
Oh, when he went. Okay, you wrote it later than that. Yeah.
It's a book about a celebration of the life of an artist.
Yeah.
He was born a hemophiliac, contracted the AIDS virus, and died when he was 8. Mm-hmm. But he chronicled his whole life in his drawing. And exhibited to Sonia and myself, my wife, an amazing wisdom and power and understanding of a situation that we were having a real hard time getting our head around, because this was back in the early, early days. Very little was known about pediatric AIDS.
Right.
It was a tumultuous time to be dealing with this and dealing with it alone, because there support structures dropped away.
Yeah,
And were fortunately replaced with better ones. I experienced this, and in looking into other like situations, discovered, well, Benjamin was a phenomenal artist, but in his wisdom and understanding, he was like other young people have exhibited in these situations. That I thought, you know, if kids have this power and understanding, by God, we need to recognize it in other times than, you know, death and dying.
Right.
And so that's what I set out to try to celebrate. The celebration of his life and his living through his art.
But do you feel like a play like that or the work of Finnegan and other folks, it's just harder to find audiences for? It's more delicate. You can't program a whole season of it, obviously.
No. But we were, I'll be honest, we were fearful.
Yeah.
We did not know how the audience was going to respond to this initially, and the kids were fine.
Yeah.
It's the adults.
It's the parents, right.
But again, they could see, you know, they experienced it through their eyes, but also through the eyes of the young people.
Right.
And I, you know, have been talking to there are numerous productions going on all the time.
Right.
And
right.
That's what's really wonderful is that, you know, Benjamin's still out there teaching. Hmm. The play is out there doing its work.
Right.
And it did help. It changed our field. It helped change us understand what things we could try.
Right.
It's frustrating because it never feels like we've as far as we should be able to.
Yeah.
It's like we just figure out a way on one little berry and whoop, pops another one.
Yeah,
that
sure.
You didn't really see happening. Who knew you couldn't say shut up, you know?
Right.
That's a bad word. You don't say that.
Are you saying you can't say that to audiences or you can't say that in a play?
In
characters
a play.
Characters no, can't no, say it.
That is no. Naughty.
But that wasn't the case 3 years ago.
Oh, really?
I don't think.
Oh, no, it's always been for us. That is a nasty, nasty word. You don't do that.
You can't say that. I know with my sons, stupid is a bad word now. My sons will say, Mom said the S word. And I'm thinking, what? She said, oh, she meant stupid.
Which is why we should not have those kids watching the political debates these days.
Yes. No,
cheers,
especially this round. This is not a time for them to watch. So you had I wanted to know, Linda, what some landmark productions from your time. I mean the one that I'm aware of because of my son's age, I was particularly interested in theater for very young audiences. That's an area of interest for me because they could go to it, you know. And I know The Green Sheep was one that was,
No, I was directing in Australia.
Oh, right, okay.
At the Adelaide, in an adult theater.
Yeah.
And I saw the Australian government put all this money behind research as to how to engage babies, not toddlers, babies.
Right.
And so the Windmill Theater developed this piece called The Green Sheep, and it was an installation piece set outside. It was with all the little Australian babies with their bonnets on so their heads wouldn't burn. And I was so taken with that. So we brought that in twice, and then we developed our own new piece called Dot and Ziggy. And what's so amazing, and then we just done another one that was done in Vancouver, Where the Wild Things Are. But you know, both of you with babies, at 3 months of age, the babies are tracking. They're able to track. At six months, they're leaning forward and you're getting an expression on their face. At 9 months, they're putting their little hands together and clapping. But the pieces, that kind of work is not just for those babies. It's for the parents to remember that creative play is absolutely necessary as you raise children. And guess what? You can do stuff with a string and a piece of a stick that doesn't cost hundreds of dollars. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we've been doing toddler work as well as baby two at the other end of the spectrum, teenage work. I mean, we brought this guy in from Iran a few years ago, and teenagers did not leave the theater for an hour afterwards. So, but if you capture them early before they're playing T-ball and you're taking them to three language classes and gymnastics and everything, you capture them when they're little. I think the habit of seeing theater for the parents and for the child will be instilled. But it's all about what we all know as theater people. Creative play should be part of our and imagination should be part of our everyday lives, no matter what kind of job we all have.
David, you mentioned, I think one of you mentioned, that the teachers don't necessarily need a famous title. I know the tyranny of the title is something that they talk about in 2A licensing. And I know it's Seattle and Children's Theater Company have their own sort of publishing division. Isn't that right, Linda?
Well, we did with Minneapolis for many years, and now pulled out of that. There are many new little publishing
Place for young audiences, yeah.
producing scripts, but both David, I think we've commissioned 115 new plays, and David has done many, many new commissions.
Right. I went to a reading at that you did at your theater, which is the first time I've seen a reading of a children's play. The Boy Who Hated Peas, was it, or loved Peas, or what was it?
The girl who loved monsters. the boy who loved monsters and the girl who loved peas.
Okay, I got it straight there. All right,
which reproduced the following year.
Right. Yeah. So it's sort of. Do you feel like you're rolling a boulder uphill there to truly try and get new children's material in there, so that it's not by Mo Willems or, a Murray Sendak or whatever?
Oh well. People that write for David, Robert Schenken writes for us. Cheryl West writes for us.
Okay,
David, Stephen Beats, Y. York. They write for us. That's who's writing for us and for him, too.
Yeah. But we've also developed writers here.
Yeah.
Right.
That are producing work that's being done around the country. So that feels good. We are all contributing to the canon, to a growing canon. And I think... It is getting richer and more complex, and there are more choices. Having said that, the strictures that are there are real, and can't be. I don't know where I'm going. There's expanding artistic possibilities in a changing artistic climate. And I think it's different from community to community. Seattle embraces stuff that Phoenix doesn't.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Vice versa.
Right.
We have a large Hispanic audience, Latino audience, that we are finding ways to reach out to, and it means looking at who, what we are, and how we do it.
Right. Right. I wanted to just you mentioned education earlier. David, and I think when a lot of people think about children's theater or theater for young audiences, they think about it primarily in terms of education. It sounds like you embrace that, obviously. It's not something you fight against, that like, oh, it's just for education.
No, educational purposes. Artistry and education are intersecting little things whirling around our nucleus.
Right.
Both of those things. And it's not, education is not didactic.
Right.
It is interpreted in very varied and holistic ways.
Right.
And I have found theater to be an amazing tool for expanding understanding and learning. And not necessarily book learning, but understanding, communication, the kind of skills that we need to get along with other people are often modeled by the experience in theater, in talking about theater afterwards.
Right.
And I think because with Theater for Young Audiences for 30, 40 years, you've seen we're all doing a play is just part of a multifaceted experience in Theater for Young Audiences. Adult theaters do this too, but most of us, besides the children, when you're dealing with schools anyway, besides coming to the theater to see the play, often there's a pre-show workshop in the school with that class. There's a post-show workshop in the school with that class. There's a post-play discussion. We always engage the audience in post-play discussion. And it's not just how did you do the fire, but you're talking about themes. And then there's always, and every theater does this, but we all are doing these study guides. And I know David's, ours looks like the Encyclopedia Britannica that goes with every show, with activities. So you want the play to be part of a multifaceted experience. So with the parent, with the teacher, with the child, you're going to go on and on and on. Rather, you know, it's, as David said, it's whole language, it's whole learning. Whether the child's going to draw a picture or like we're doing Brooklyn Bridge now by Melissa Gibson, who's the lead writer for House of Cards.
This
is an A-plus script. And so some
script.
Of the kids hopefully are going to go home and build their own. They're going to be engineers someday and build their own bridges. So Theater for Young Audiences is doing all kinds of things and have been doing this for 40 years.
Right.
And besides seeing a good play, you're going to engage their head, their heart, and their hands.
I think there's much more high-quality TYA work available now than there was when you started, you know, not to disparage the work that was there, but there's so much more. And yet a lot of the things, the challenges have in some ways become greater, you know, the cost of things, real estate, audiences you mentioned. If you were starting a theater like this now, could you start a theater like this now? Or would you do something different? I guess you're probably figuring that out. Your theaters are figuring that out as they, you know, go into the future.
I know it's possible because I have people working for me who have started their own theater, and I am encouraging them and supporting them. It's a different kind of work, but they're young people still have that drive, and that need to build their own personal home,
right? An artistic home.
That's what drove this. Driving your artistic home or creating your artistic home. And for me, an artistic home for a whole ensemble of artists.
Right.
We now consider our entire staff and board a part of the ensemble. That's
right.
A change. In the early days, it was just the little core of artists, you know, toiling away in the desert. But we came to understand that we need community partners in order to be able to reach the audiences that we need and that we want to. And so that's been an evolution. If I think back, I saw a show at the Children's Theater in Minneapolis when I was, I think, in probably first year of college. I had never, ever seen anything so visually exciting and wonderful in my life. My senior year, I got to see the opening of the Guthrie.
Okay.
With that entire, I mean, I was sort of like deluged in all this amazing theater that was being born in the Twin Cities.
Wow.
And all of those theater experiences led me to want to create a home.
Right.
For myself and for other people who felt that way.
Sure.
And to connect to other homes like Linda's, like Peter's in Minneapolis, like Jeff in Coleraine, Carol in Metro, you know, these partners that became really a part of the whole artistic DNA of my company as well.
Right.
I think there was very much an exchange of energy and support and love between that very much helped us all.
Right.
The tough times and the good times.
Great. I was going to ask you what's next for both of you. Are you going to? I know you're going to direct. You're going to direct a little bit of your theater in the future, David. As sort of an emeritus. Is that also what you're going to do, Linda? Or are you going to move on?
Yeah, I have a couple of projects with the theater. I have two dreams. I want to work on gun safety issues, and I want to somehow convince America, whether it's in the state of Washington, the city of Seattle, or it's in Louisiana, that art should be part of our everyday lives. I'm sick of penny wise, pound foolish, and I think the science is finally catching up with how children need to learn and creative thing. It should be STEAM, not STEM. And I somehow, whether it's politically or working with I don't know, volunteering, want to convince people that from the time a child can talk and walk, as well as adults, that we need to get visual music, performing arts into our everyday lives at home and in the schools. And it's necessary, and it's what makes life worth living, but it's also going to give people marketable skills when they grow up. So that's what I'd like to work on.
And I also want to say, we talked about education.
Yeah.
What I didn't mention is the pretty amazing work that we're doing with ASU, or is in the state, and various school districts working with teachers.
Yeah.
And over 3 and 4 year periods of time, and we have demonstrable results.
Yeah.
That reading scores improve. All of that. We're We're using theater to provide the data that will put the A back in STEM, put it back to STEAM.
Yeah, go on.
Well, I was just going to go back really quickly to just to add on to what David said about what's changed. Obviously, the word goes out about what we're doing on stage and how people feel about it in one nanosecond when it didn't 35 years ago. And hopefully maybe we audiences want to be engaged more directly, in a more intimate way, perhaps than when we started. I hated participation theater when I started because I thought you pulled kids in and you told them where to look and got them to clap and then you slapped them in the face in a way and went, we don't need your attention. We don't need your input anymore. I hated it. But now I can see that it's highly theatrical to involve the audience in a lot of ways. And yet, what's so wonderful about theater needs to still be maintained as it was in the ancient days in Greece when you saw Trojan women in Delphi. And that is the institution, the facility is a sacred place, not unlike a mosque, a synagogue, or a church where people come together in a collective way and gather. I know at David's Theater, which is so beautiful, and ours, when kids come, when adults come, it is special, it is different, it puts them into another place, and I don't think that will ever change.
I agree with you.
The power of story goes on, it's just how we tell it that needs to change
and adapt and grow.
Adapt, thank you. And I want to look at how immigration suddenly became a bad thing in America.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, God.
I think there's some things to look at there and engage young people in that conversation.
I'm from Arizona, David, and I don't even remember it being as bad when I was growing up there
as it is now. It's borderline toxic, and that's very disturbing. Yeah.
And kids are not like that. You know, I mean, you've got to be carefully taught, right?
Yes.
Isn't that a lyric from one of the most famous musicals ever? And it's just, and children, you know, Dave and I make speeches all the time, get asked what's different about theater for young audiences and adults. And I just say, you know, no, we don't promise them everything's great, but children are not cynical. So an 11-year-old does not deserve to hear that the world is a horrible place and life is ruined.
Right.
So somehow, like with incredible productions of A Yellow Boat, as David said, you know, it is adults weep, but children see the love and the imagination and the joy that this little boy was given through art. And then, so, you know, that's what David and I are going to keep working on, because children are good and happy and trusting and loyal. And somehow when we all go through puberty, we get mean and cynical. And so we got to figure that out. Got to go back to what it was like when you were a little boy in Arizona.
But I also think that you just hit on one of the primary differences between adult theater and young. I believe theater for young people must have hope.
Yes, right. Me too.
I think it must have hope. You don't necessarily need that in adult theater, but I think for young people, we owe it to them.
Right.
And that's not saccharine, you know, honey, Pollyanna, whatever. It's just, if things are bad, we have the power to make them different. We have the power to change.
Right, right. I mean, you feel like that needs to be part of the explicit content, because for me as a theater goer, an adult theater goer, what I usually take away, even from a bleak theater piece, is the communion of theater somehow made that transcendent. But for kids, you're saying they need that needs to be part of the message explicitly, at least on some level.
I think that what you just said, the experience of theater.
Yeah.
May be enough to provide that.
Right, right.
But somehow or other, the notion has to be addressed. I don't want to say it's got to be a hopeful message, or else that's just reinforcing everything I don't believe in.
Yeah, you know? No, sure.
The overall experience has to leave them with a sense of hope.
Yeah.
And you said when you see a bleak play, the thing is you weren't experiencing that strong kind of experience in a room by yourself.
No.
Like that boy that sat alone in his room, the boy that killed all those kids in Columbine. And he bragged about he had a refrigerator in his room and a computer, so he never had to leave his room.
No.
You see a play like that, and you're sitting in a room with other people, and somehow there's a strength that you go, oh, we've all seen something sad. It's a communal experience, and we cannot be isolated in theater. Does that. I agree with David. Somehow, some way, a child deserves, through one character, through one idea, to see something hopeful and something positive. We did David's Tale of Two Cities.
Right.
And that's a perfect example of, as that guy's, what's the famous guy, he's going up onto the guillotine, he takes the hand of the young woman next to him.
Right.
And that's a perfect example of theater for young audiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
Thanks for doing this. Oh my gosh! Thank you so much.
What's inspiring to talk to you both? Makes you want to go.
Your notion of the hope can come from the act of being in a community experiencing something hopeless.
Yeah.
You know, I mean that's a better solution. That's a better definition of what I was trying to say. Okay. Because that's the power of theater. It can do that.
Well, I wasn't explicitly trained by both of you to think that way, but I was trained by good children's theater and by great theater along the way. And so thank you for your
fantastic.
Thank you. Words.
Thanks for doing this. Thank you so much.
It's such a pleasure. All right. Bye now.
Okay. Bye. Thanks. Bye.
Welcome back. That was fun. Thank you for listening. And now we have things that we think you should look at. Russ, why don't you start?
Sure. And just a quick note to say that we described our interviewees as pioneers, and pioneer happens to be a favorite word of Stephen Sondheim, whose birthday it is today, the day of our recording, March 22nd. It's also the birthday of Andrew Lloyd Webber. That's a detail that many theater aficionados like to giggle at. Also just discovered that it's the birthday of Reese Witherspoon, as well as Chico Marx and Marcel Marceau. So it's a great day for birthdays in the performing arts, or specifically, the film and theater arts. So, so for recommendations for this time around, I saw The Way West at Labyrinth Theater Company. This is the new Mona Mansour play, premiered at Steppenwolf, we believe. And this is running through the first weekend of April. So go check it out. This is a great piece. I'm always excited to see plays that focus on multiple women. We have more than enough plays focusing on guys. So to have pieces that really look at motherhood and sisterhood and daughterhood, it's pretty exciting, and the storytelling is very compelling as well. What's it about? It is about a mom who is going bankrupt, and her daughters come in to try to bail her out. And in doing so, things unravel in their lives, the two daughters, and we see their relationships with other people, and we see this family kind of fall apart a little bit, but they do it in such, an artistic way. It's just, it's a great piece, and it begins breaking the fourth wall with storytelling, and to start a fairly realistic play in that way is pretty exciting to me. So to have this very colorful Western mom and lead with storytelling, and then break into the the kind of family drama in the living room is just it's a great way to start a play, I think. So all around an enjoyable piece, and check it out.
Right. Well, and I saw an early reading of it a couple of years ago, I think around 2012, 2013 at the Lark. And I remember it, even though it's about this woman who is bankrupt and who's going to lose her house, I remember it being really funny.
True. It is. Yeah. It is. Yeah. And it's always a deft hand that's able to weave humor and a really serious situation. Yeah.
Like financial issues, not explored in a theater so much. I really like it when people do.
Yes.
Awesome. Great recommendation. What do you have, Allison?
Well, last week I saw Bright Star in previews, and ooh, it opens tomorrow night. This is Steve Martin and Edie Brickwell's musical. I loved it. I didn't know what to expect with bluegrass music. But the story takes place, it kind of toggles between the 1920s and the 1940s in North Carolina along the Appalachian Mountains. And it goes back and forth between this young love, between this editor and a soldier who comes home from the war. And it goes back between when this young writer is now an editor, and she is looking back at her past and this traumatic event that had happened with her lover. And I don't want to spoil anything, but there are lots of oohs and ahs and audible gasps to be had. And it was just a joy. It was just a lot of fun. The songs are still stuck in my head. So go see Bright Star. It opens tomorrow.
Right. And I'm just enamored with Carmen Cusack's performance.
She was incredible.
Yes. Well, the show had a prior run at the Old Globe and then at the Kennedy Center. And she's been with it for all of those productions. And she plays a woman in her 20s and then a woman in her 40s. And so the way she 15, wait.
Yeah, I think she starts off being 15.
Yeah, and then she ends at almost 40. And so you believe her as a 15-year-old because it's just the amazing way, like, she holds herself at both ages and the way that she changes her voice, too, mm-hmm. like her singing voice. It becomes almost more youthful and more twangy, which is amazing. You don't really see that very often in the theater as well.
Yeah,
like it was this kind of versatility.
It was very subtle the way that she would go back and forth between the scenes. And it was, like you said, like, you know, that's usually not how it goes when you're sitting there watching. But I believed it the whole way through.
Right. So go see Bright Star. We recommend it, me and Allison. And my recommendation this week, I spent Saturday night watching Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill on HBO Go, starring Audra McDonald and directed by Lonnie Price. I didn't get to see it when it ran on Broadway at Circle in the Square, but I know that it's a play that's been done quite a bit around the country with showcasing the vocal talents of many African-American actresses doing their best Billie Holiday impression. And from what I saw on HBO, and afterwards, I listened to some of Billie Holiday's songs again. Like, the way that Audra does the phrasing and the way that she makes her voice so brittle to portray, like, the final months of Billie Holiday's life is, like, she deserved that Tony. For anyone who hasn't seen the play, it's set in a cafe where Billie Holiday is performing some of her most well-known songs while telling stories about her life. And it takes place 4 months before she dies at the age of 44. And it's funny and tragic and just makes you realize what a life this woman had and just how unfairly she was treated despite being like one of the best jazz vocalists of her generation. So I recommend that. If you don't have HBO Go or HBO Now, spend $15 and go get an HBO Now subscription, because then you can see all kinds of great theatrical related works like Lady Day. And also they have Angels in America on HBO Now too. So have fun with that.
I think HBO also employs a lot of theater actors.
Yeah.
So you're supporting theater that way, too, if we want to stretch.
Well, thank you both for coming on today. And thank you for listening. Please review us on iTunes. And if you need links to anything that we talked about today, you can find that on americantheater.org. We will see you next time.